The Guardian.
I'm really pleased to have Jim Crace with us. I was trying to think of a kind of blanket description in a couple of sentences which would cover your oeuvre, Jim, because I've noticed that one of the many virtues of Jim's fiction is that it rather challenges reviewers to do that, and they have quite a tough time doing it because, apart from anything else, they often clearly don't know where his novels are going to go next. And I mean that in a sort of metaphorical way, but also in a geographical way and a temporal way too, because, as you might know, I mean, not just quarantine, but most of Jim's novels, I think all of them really, take us to quite remote places and often remote times. And that's true of the latest one, The Pest House, as well, which takes us to some strange place, some version of America, I suppose, in some remote future. And indeed, Jim's first novel, I think, was Continent, wasn't it? Which actually invents a new continent, a seventh continent. So he's kind of quite keen on finding strange and kind of parallel places. I first came on Jim Crace's fiction, I suppose, 9 or 10 years ago, when my brother, who's a lawyer and thus a person with poetic yearnings...
I want to be a lawyer.
..gave me the novel that I think came after Quarantine, Being Dead, for Christmas. And I think it only recently come out, and because it was my brother and it was in hardback, I felt I had to immediately read it, even though I thought, this is the most off-putting topic I can think of. It's a novel. Again, Jim's agent's here this evening, and he must have gone to the agent and said, David, his agent, said, well, my next novel's about two people who are murdered and about their decomposing bodies. And it's fantastic. It's absolutely bewitching, amazing that you could do that. And there's a kind of alchemy about taking these extraordinarily, sometimes remote and sometimes strange topics. And quarantine, of course, Jim takes something that even Victorian novelists, because I'm a great lover of Victorian fiction, and even Victorian novelists who made novels out of everything. I mean, they wrote novels about everything. Every period of history, every famous or mythical figure you could imagine. But I went this afternoon to the person in my department who knows most about sort of 19th and early 20th century novels. I said, are there any novels that have Jesus in them? And she said, what, as a character? I said, yeah, as a character, any novels? And she racked her brains and she found a very, very obscure one about Jesus reborn in 19th century London. But I said, no, I mean Jesus, you know, Jesus in the Holy Land, in his own time. And she said, isn't there a funny man called Crace who's done that? So it's an extraordinary sort of topic, Jesus. And I wonder if we could start with Jesus. I mean, I'm not going to ask you, why do you choose Jesus? Okay. But I just want to ask you about, I don't know, something about how Jesus is represented in it. Because as I'm sure most people here know, it takes Quarantine, the title and the novel, takes Jesus's 40 days in the desert, as the Gospels tell us, tempted by Satan, his 40 days of fasting in the desert. In this novel, I suppose, it had the peculiar effect on me of making me feel that even though it pays little homage to the biblical account, it made me feel quite sort of religiously interested in that biblical account again. I wondered if when you wrote it, when you were writing it, you felt that you were, as it were, licensed to invent the Jesus you wanted, or whether you had to write something which in some ways wasn't going to contradict or wasn't going to quite undermine the sort of the account that there was in the Bible.
Well, I didn't actually give it a moment of thought. And the reason for that is not because I was being dismissive of that whole background, it's because I didn't intend to write a novel in which Jesus was more than a minor character worth a sentence or two. That was all that was going to happen. This was a book. I mean, maybe I need to explain this, and I explained it in my article in the Guardian on Saturday. But the background of this book is that at the top of my street in Birmingham, there was a hostel which was turned over under the years of Thatcher into a place where people who had mental health problems were getting so-called care in the community, which of course meant no care in the community, no decent housing, no good food, no medication, etc. And they wandered around the suburb in which I lived in, rather like the characters in One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest. And it rather fascinated me this. And I managed one day to go round this hostel and see the place that they were living in. And what they were living in was a hostel with about 80 rooms, all tiny rooms like cells. And there were these people living next door to each other, schizophrenic, next door to an alcoholic, next door to a drug addict, next door to someone who's just a manic depressive. Nothing in common except that their lives existed on the edge. Now, if I was a realist writer, I could have set a novel in a mental health hostel under Thatcherite Britain in the 1970s, 1980s. But because I'm a fabulist writer, someone that likes metaphor, I was looking for a parallel, a place in which I could set that subject matter, which would dislocate the reader rather than locate the reader. The reader wouldn't be saying, this is Thatcherite England, I recognise Birmingham, it smells like that, it tastes like that, it looks like that. I wanted to set it somewhere else that would dislocate the reader. And one day, through the post, I have it here, I received a postcard. This is great podcasting, this is. And what it is, it's a picture.
If I was a good broadcast, I'd say, describe it, Jim.
I'm about to describe it. It's a photograph of Jebel Kurental, the Hill of Temptation, or the Hill of 40 Days, Kurental, like in the French. The Hill of 40 Days, where Christ was supposed to have spent, the historical Christ was supposed to have spent his 40 days of doing battles with the devil. And what I noticed about this rock face was there wasn't just one man-made cave in there, there were hundreds. So unless Jesus needed three or four caves a day, I made the leap of the presumption, and it wasn't based on any historical knowledge at all, that at the time that Christ was dealing with his devils in a cave in Palestine, that lots of other people were also dealing with their devils, whether it was the devil of having cancer or being barren or whatever it was, they would be there. And then, of course, it struck me that this was a parallel to the Palm Court Hotel, as it was called, at the top of my road. There were even palm trees. That here were people all living on the edge, all in cells next door to each other, with nothing in common except that their lives were in meltdown. So that was the beginning of the book. And at this point, I thought, this is set at the time of Christ, and at some point, I need to mention Christ in a sentence, just to give a kind of historical provenance to what was going on. But when it came to it, and this is the spooky thing, I remember very well writing that chapter in which Christ has his one sentence. And then it expanded, it became a paragraph. And then it expanded and became a chapter. And at the end of that chapter, at the beginning of this book, I'd written a chapter in which the devil figure had been saved from death by the Christ figure. And at that point, that's the point where a book abandons you and you realize that you've got something on your hands that you didn't think you had. And so your original intentions are shouldered away and new intentions come into place. So now I had Jesus Christ as a main character in a book by an atheist, someone who didn't believe in Christ at all. So the question you're asking, you know, I didn't have to ask myself those questions because Christ muscled in into the book.
Yeah, I mean, it's funny, you're giving him, as it were, companions, although he scarcely acknowledges those companions, but you're giving him those companions has the effect, because we do inhabit each of the characters to some extent for some period, including we inhabit Jesus's consciousness, does have the effect, maybe just because as a novelist you need to kind of extend that kind of sympathy, that point of view to each of them in turn, makes the business of, let's call it, sort of self-mortification, the idea of going out into the wilderness, and in Jesus's case actually starving, he has no food or water, and the other sort of eat and drink at night. Mm-hmm. But actually makes it seem quite a kind of, I don't know, natural human inclination, you know. So rather than these people being, I mean, it's really interesting, the analogy with the care in the community, the psychiatrically ill, because you might, I would say, idiomatically and carelessly, that one important thing about the book is you don't think these people are mad at all. I didn't when they...
No. Well, they had good rational reasons to go out into the desert because medicine wasn't sufficient to deal with cancer. Magic, such as it wasn't sufficient to deal with someone that thought they were barren, wrongly thought she was barren. There are good reasons to seize on whatever you can find. Meditation, it seemed quite rational to imagine meditation would help things. So that's what all of these characters are doing. They're meditating in one way or another in order to solve their problems.
And you didn't do any... I mean, I think I've read you saying that you actually didn't really do kind of research particularly.
Well, you don't need to... Research is for non-fiction books.
Yeah.
You know, and if I wanted to write a non-fiction book about it, I would have written a socialist atheistic tract which didn't allow for any nuance. But as it was, I was writing a work of fiction, and fiction is not about information, it's about vocabulary. I actually was given an award by the Society of Authors, a travel award. So I thought, I will go to Palestine, I will go and have a look at the Judean desert, because they were giving me some money to travel, and I'm very puritanical about these things, I always do what I'm told. So I did go to Palestine for 3 weeks, and I got myself a Bedouin guide called Abu Rabia, who was a real modern guy. He had his cell phone on one hip and he had his gun on the other hip, and he spoke about six languages, and he was a great companion, took me around the Judean desert. One morning we woke up under his jeep, and I was stretching myself looking out over the dawn of the Judean desert, and he said to me, well, Jim, how did you sleep? And I said to him, I slept like a log. And as I said that to him, I slept like a log, I saw his eyes narrow, not because he didn't understand it, because his English was perfect, but because he was looking over my shoulder, and he could see the Judean desert. And he knew the idea of sleeping like a log was a metaphor that just did not travel. There were no logs. All there was maybe in the far, far distance, a very, very dry thorn tree. If there'd have been a log, it wouldn't have slept. It would have been on the fire straight away. Because there's nothing worse than having a fire made out of camel dung. It really makes your eyes water. And so the metaphor, I slept like a log, just was never going to work. So being a smart-assed English guy, I knew what he was thinking. And I said to him, OK, Izzat, how did you sleep? And I used the phrase in the beginning of one of the chapters at the end of the book. He says, me, I slept like a donkey. I slept like a dead donkey. If you'd have kicked me, I wouldn't have woken up. And what that taught me was, this is the point of what I'm telling you, what that taught me was that if you were going to write this book convincingly in the English language, but inhabit the world of Judea 2,000 years ago, the key was not information and knowledge and research. The key was a language vocabulary trick to remember to turn your logs into donkeys. And basically, that's what this book does. It turns logs into donkeys.
Uh-huh. Well, maybe this is a good point to ask you, because when we were talking beforehand, I asked, written a couple of columns about the novel, and I asked Jim if he'd read them, and he said that he had, and he very politely said how interesting he found them, which is quite often what novelists do. Very interesting, your comment.
No, yeah, they were great articles.
And but he said,
No.
Last month, Jane Smiley actually gave me a hug, so obviously physical contact has become a sort of feature of the...
Americans hug people all the time.
But Jim said he really disagreed with something that I'd written about the language, I think, which you were just talking about the language.
Yes, you were ascribing... one of the things that you were saying was that the narrative voice uses language to describe what each individual character is feeling, but uses language that those characters themselves would not have known. And of course, that's quite legitimate to do that, because the one of the first decisions you make when you're telling any story is where the narrator is. Well, first of all, is the narrator first-person narrator? Is the person a narrator that's on the ground with the characters in the way that Nick Carraway is in The Great Gatsby? Yeah. Or is the narrator a great hovering eagle looking down and knowing everything? And my narrator in this is a great hovering eagle. It's a godlike character that does know everything. And so it would be legitimate for that person to know words that the characters didn't know. But the examples you gave were what I was going to argue with. You gave an example, the fact that the word pandemonium was a word which they couldn't possibly have known then because it was a coinage by Milton in the 17th century. Whereas actually, and the reason that I'm even mentioning this, I remember the day that I used that word and I thought I was so clever because even though I knew it was Miltonic, and the whole book has got references to Milton all the way through, you know, the whole business of the devil having the best tunes, you know, Milton runs like a fissure through the whole way, the whole of this book. But I avoided virtually all of the coinages except pandemonium, because pandemonium isn't a coinage by Milton. It's a piece of Greek. It just means all the demons. Pandemonium, that's all it means. And as I had explained quite carefully, and you weren't paying attention in this book, was that a lot of the conversation goes on in Greek.
Yeah.
And so these characters do speak Greek.
Yeah.
And so the word pandemonium actually would have been very familiar to them. But,
No,
you made me seem petty, very clever.
No, I think that's sort of 40 love, at least, you know. Yes, I what about, there were some other words, though. There were some...
Well, you said quarantine was an abstract term noun. You're just laying yourself open to being humiliated, aren't you?
No, I was thinking...
It's no more abstract noun than the word week or month or year, is it? It's a specific...
But the word that... No, I was, I suppose, thinking that the title that you've chosen... returns us to a sense of the word which we lost or which dictionaries tell us about, but we don't usually use it anymore. But was actually also using the kind of modern sense as well.
Mm.
Is that not right?
It is right. Juice.
There's one more thing before we leave juice.
This is not to be argumentative. No. I mean, this stuff interests me, you know, that sometimes you get, when you're writing a book, the big picture is what matters, but actually, very often the big picture is delivered by the minutiae, and a specific word can be so powerful and can colour a whole chapter, and I suppose that reading your article all these years later made me relive some of these.
Yeah, well, I mean, the pandemonium one is a good point. You're actually, in a way, your point's even better, because the thing about the language of the novel, I'm fascinated actually by novels that are written in a way that they sort of take place in some other language, actually, because although they're written in English, we have to imagine that the characters themselves are not English, and that the issue of what language people are speaking comes up, and you say things like, I think, isn't it the first time Jesus speaks? You say it's that mixture of that place where Aramaic flirts with Greek.
Mm-hmm.
And we have to imagine a sort of language which none of the readers...
And of course I know nothing about Aramaic or Greek. It's just a trick. It's a trickery.
Yes.
It's the writer pretends to be knowledgeable and to hold your eye without blinking. And people will buy whatever it is you say. You know, there are invented birds in there. There are virtually half of the details, which look as if they're research, are entirely invented. And maybe, you know, you were saying earlier that I sent a lot of my novels in invented places. And the reason I do that is just so that I am then free to make things up. Because the Puritan part of me, if I were to have set a novel in Thatcherite Birmingham, or I were to set a novel in a real Bombay or a real country in the Third World instead of an invented continent, as in the novel Continent. Because I'm puritanical, I would feel it was my duty to give a proper photographic mirror image of how it really was. Maybe that's the ex-journalist in me. But because I set all of my books, including Quarantine, in made-up places, I can be what I was when I was a kid. You know, when I was a kid, I used to lay on my stomach in the front room of our flat, and I used to draw islands full of detail, full of made-up detail, or pages in atlases that didn't exist. And to some extent, that's what I'm still doing. I'm inventing places because I find it fun to do so.
But there's a kind of... But I mean, no one... I don't think reading it, most people would think, oh, you know, this is great, he's done tons and tons of research to make this historical reality live. But there is... I think you are aware of, I was aware of, and I suppose sort of got pleasure from, a kind of I don't know, what seemed to be a kind of rigour about the language that you use. So you say, oh, you can imagine it how you want. But I feel it feels very carefully written so that you're not going to let somebody suddenly think, oh, that sounds like my next door neighbour, or those are the kind of sentences I hear every day. I mean, you use quite simple sentences a lot of the time, but it is, I don't know, I don't know if you think this is an accurate description, but they feel like quite bleached out descriptions where you're not going to allow any of the sort of vocabulary clutter that you might find in a novel with a contemporary setting into the book.
Well, maybe your vocabulary is limited because you can't use any words that have got a modern derivation. I mean, apart from pandemonium, of
sinuses.
Course.
Sinuses.
Yeah. Do I use the word
you
sinuses?
You use the word sinuses. Yeah.
Yeah. What's the derivation of sinuses? Any
no
idea?
Idea no.
That's Latin, isn't it?
I don't know where sinuses comes from.
I think sinuses is all right, isn't it? I think they had sinuses in Jesus' time. I think that sometimes I think I'm frightened of over egging the cake, as it were,
yeah.
And so I draw back. But maybe one of the things is that I'm very aware of writing in a kind of oral tradition. That's what influences me a lot. I'm very attentive to the music and the rhythm of the way that sentences sound like. And so even though the vocabulary might not be complicated, it might be simple, the percussion of each sentence is very complicated, and I attend to it very closely. So there's always a drum beat running through my sentences. Adam Mars Jones said to read a paragraph in any novel by Jim Crace is to invite a migraine.
No.
Yes, because it's quite a smart remark, because they are so musically based and because they're so rhythmically based. So I'm careful with those things. But I don't know. The thing is, it's wrong. You're asking me questions about things that I'm not self-conscious about.
Yeah.
If you're lucky enough to find your voice as a writer, it comes naturally. And so you're really not aware of what you're doing. I know that the things I can do. I know I've got what my natural voice is, and I just write them on autopilot.
Well, let me ask you, let's sort of switch from the language to the characters, because one of the... I know you were saying you hadn't really intended to give Jesus more than a sentence, but one of the... if you're reading the novel for the first time, and you know perhaps in advance what story you're revisiting, the very striking thing is the particular tangent at which you approach it via this in some ways kind of disgusting character, although he's kind of interesting as well, Musso, who's the man who's dying in his tent at the beginning of the story, and his wife's tending to him. And he becomes a kind of, in some ways, he's the central character of the novel. He actually, in his own thoughts, there's this very striking thing, I was rereading it today, something you say something about his childhood, how he has two aspects, his character. The nasty, ruthless, successful, dominant, predatory, I suppose he's predatory, isn't he? And then a tearful twin he keeps well hidden inside himself. And then he comes across Jesus, although in slightly hallucinatory circumstances. And Jesus is he thinks of Jesus as his lesser twin. And that phrase is his thought, I take it, his sort of perception. And I just wondered if you could say, because at the end of the novel, it's actually sort of Jesus dies, but Musa sees a figure and thinks Jesus has been reborn. And Musa is the person who sort of becomes the agent of taking that unlikely story of resurrection out into the world. And I just wondered if you could say something about why you'd given him that sort of agency, this extraordinary reprobate.
Well, first of all, I, of course, whether Jesus dies or not is an ambiguity,
yes,
that is left open at the end of the book. And that ambiguity can be there for both kind of readers. It can be there for the kind of atheist reader who can believe that, of course, if someone dies, there can't be no resurrection, because an atheist doesn't believe in resurrection. And that atheist reader can look at the book and say, the Christian myth, the myth of Christ, is something which has been brought into the world by a storyteller. Because not only is the devil, Musa, he's not only the devil figure, but he's also the storytelling figure. And so that's quite a combination. A man goes down into the world. He's a merchant. He understands trade. He knows how to tell stories. He's wicked. He's motivated by wickedness. And so that would be a kind of rational explanation for the Jesus myth. That's the one thing that the atheists who read it can latch onto. The other possibility, of course, if you're a Christian person, if you're a believer of any kind, and oddly, when I look at my mail, this is a book which tends to underscore people's belief in God, not undermine it. The people who've written to me that do believe in God, for them, it's completely logical that there has been, that Jesus could have died and been resurrected. Because after all, the Jesus story is about death and resurrection. And all that that quarantine does is to provide two deaths and resurrections in Jesus' life in just the one. And it makes it kind of neater in a way, because it would suggest that Jesus' mission on earth, which he only begins in the Bible, if you read the biblical verses, it only begins after he's come away from being tempted by the devil. That brief period of his mission on earth starts with his death and resurrection, and it then will end with his death and resurrection on the cross. And so there's this kind of weird ambiguity there. And I, even though I couldn't have articulated it before I started writing the book, I couldn't have articulated anything before I started writing the book, because I wanted the book to offer things up to me. When I reached the end of the book, I realized that this was the ambiguity I was after all the time. I really wasn't after a Thatcherite satire. I really was after a book which was ambiguous about God and religion in a way that I wasn't, because I wanted to challenge my own atheism. And in order to deliver that kind of ambiguity, I needed somebody who could straddle both these things. And that was why, that was how the Musa character came about. Because he served all my purposes. And he could serve both purposes at the same time, which is why he's a twin.
Yeah. And you sort of see it, you do see things through his eyes a bit. And I think that, I don't know, it had, I don't think I'm particularly religious, but I think in a way, even whatever you think about that ambiguous ending, your book had the effect of making Jesus seem, partly through the eyes of this wicked man, a holy person, you know. And just as we might say about somebody who, without sharing any of their religious beliefs, who we might, you know, somebody in retreat in the desert, there are still these people, you might say, well, actually, that is a holy person and sort of above earthly things in a way that sort of Jesus in the chapters devoted to him becomes in a sort of hallucinatory way.
There was a case while I was writing the book, or soon after I've written the book, of an American woman that went up into the hills of Scotland. I don't, you might remember this case in the 1990s, and she went up and starved herself to death for hallucinogenic reasons. If she wasn't mad when she started off, she would have been mad at the end. So there's this mixture of being genuinely religious and naive and young, which is what my Jesus is, but ending up mad and dead. And I was interested in that. But, there was no... Jesus was just one of those people that we encounter in our lives, and I don't happen to be one of these people, and never has been one of these people, who genuinely are rocked and moved and transformed and transcended by their religious belief.
I actually, as I wrote in one of my columns, I ended up being sort of peculiarly moved by this sort of funeral that takes place, you know, with a kind of dead bird and sort of herbs and things they found.
I haven't got there yet.
Oh, you haven't? Jim's been rereading it. He's worried that...
Well, you know, you never read your own books. Why would you read your own books?
We did Ian Rankin, and he reread the novel on the way down from Edinburgh, and he was absolutely...
Well, I only live in Birmingham. I live in Birmingham. I got to page... I got about three quarters of the way through, so I can't remember what happened. But you don't... It's a strange thing, you know, with books. You never have a reader's experience of your own books, because even if I was reading it today, I was very aware of the things that didn't make it in the final cut, the things that that I'd thought of that that didn't work, the things that did work that got bloated instead of remained simple. You can never have a fresh experience. You always know what the last page is, and so it's kind of not much of an experience reading your own novels, which is why I don't do it.
You give, I mean, Musa, like you say, is a storyteller, so he's the guy in a way destined to tell this, this story of a kind of a miracle. You give him this amazing story, which I was quite as rapt, but as the listeners, about taking monkeys across the desert.
Yeah.
Was that sort of something you completely fabricate? He's trading. He's always trading in things, and he carries these monkeys kind of strung upside down on the side of camels, is it?
Or he's been, as I remember, because I only read it today, somebody bests him by telling the story of how to find honey.
Yes.
It's a very simple thing. I think I invented this.
Yeah, you
capturing bees and then letting them go and following them one at a time until they take you to the hive. And he wants to better this. And so he comes up with a story of using captive monkeys to find water. And no, I just made it up because it's fiction. And but the thing to remember is that it's not hard to make up the stuff you can make up.
Yes.
You know, for example, there's lots of natural history in this book, and there's lots of natural history in all of my books. And it's not because I make that up out of the blue. I make it up out of a background of being an amateur natural historian. I couldn't make up stuff about chemistry. I know nothing about chemistry or about rugby football. But I can make stuff up about natural history because that's my subject matter. And I'm very aware of traditional storytellings. I know about African folk tales. And so making one up isn't such a big stretch for me. But it's fun to do it.
Yeah.
And it's the kind of thing that in realist fiction you can't do. I'm writing a realist fiction book at the moment, and one of the things I'm missing is I can't have these complete flights of fancy in the way that I could in quarantine.
And the desert, I mean, seems... Because several of your novels are set in quite, I suppose, bare places,
yeah.
So to put it at its sort of most general. And your Justin Cartwright, reviewing, I think, your most recent novel, said Jim was the laureate of the mineral, the bacterial, and the gaseous.
But he makes it sound horrible.
No, I think he meant it.
He meant well.
I think he did. I think he did. But I was talking about being dead, and the tiny processes become narratively fascinating here. And there's stuff, I don't know, you will have got to this bit quite near the beginning. There's a description... that I can't imagine any other novelist, any other contemporary novelist doing of, I mean, I can imagine the episode, but not the description she digs the grave for Musa.
Yes.
She thinks he's going to die, but he doesn't. And then the grave fills with water by chance. Yes. So she's dug in the place where there's underground water and seepage. And they drink. And then there's a description. You're looking in the water, as it were, with her. And you see all these kind of little... sort of bugs and roaches and things coming out, you know, as if this kind of, I don't know, to me, as if this sort of fecund life is just waiting for this opportunity, and they're all tiny, slimy things. But it's not disgusting at all, it's sort of fascinating.
No, there's no disgust, and the thing is that's what, in a way, I'm trying to save the natural world. I'm on some kind of mission. And that we think too often that the natural world comprises of kingfishers and daffodils and rainbows. And actually, to think that that's what the natural world comprises of is to despise the natural world. That it's truer about our world that we live in to say that it comprises of dead things. Because that's what the earth comprises of, dead leaves. There's more bones in the world than there are living creatures at the moment. And so that's what I try and do in my fiction, not to create a dark view of our universe, but to say, let's glorify in this natural world which is all around us, in all its aspects. And if you can't embrace it all, you're not embracing it at all. And so this is why the natural world exists in all of my books. And it's also to do with the fact that, even though I don't have religious feeling, what I do feel is that we've somehow become separated in the 21st century from the natural world. Just look around you in this room. And where is the natural world in this room except for us? What you have is things that have been, you know, look at that. That thing is beyond nature, isn't it? This thing is beyond nature. This
Jim
thing
Grass is beyond microphone nature. At
this stage. These things are beyond nature. And we tend to think that that is the world that we encounter day by day. I've been walking around, walking across bridges, going down roads. I've been to art museums. Things are beyond, everything I've seen today has been beyond nature. But actually, in the end, nature has the last say. And if Armageddon comes, it's going to be interesting to see what nature does to that. And so the kind of zealot's mission that I have, this zealot's mission which is godless, but nevertheless is still in awe of the universe in the way that people who believe in God is in awe of the universe. That mission is to say that the natural world is worthy of glorifying and celebrating in all of its aspects.
So there is a sort of relationship, just like, I mean, in your self-description as a zealot, there is a sort of relationship between the kind of wonderfully imagined setting for this novel and the kind of, and the sort of, the pilgrimage, the religious zealotry of the main characters. Because, I mean, in both ways, the desert's like a lens, isn't it? I mean, and so they're very, one of my favourite things, in some of the reviews it said, oh, but the incredibly vivid imagination of the Judean desert, which is true, but there's also lots of stuff about sounds and the sounds of it, and these people in their caves at night, and they can hear all the sounds get sort of magnified. And it's like, of course, the sort of the quarantine that they are undertaking sort of concentrates and enlarges everything, doesn't it? Both the natural and, in a way, the religious. So there is a sort of, it's as if they do become hypersensitized, or the novel through them becomes hypersensitized.
Well, if you're not a believer in God, you're supposed to be, what is the opposite to hyper?
Hypo.
There's not a hypo, is it?
Hypo, I think, for doctors.
Okay,
yes.
There's not a successful way for atheists to be hypersensitized about these grand issues. This is one of my arguments with what I see as the failings of sort of 21st and 20th century atheism. Because actually, I have a lot in common with believers, except the belief in God. You know, I'm fearful of death. That's one of the main reasons why people need to have narratives of comfort which are provided by religion. I'm in awe of the universe. Sometimes my brain seems to dissolve when it suddenly occurs to me that I'm here at all. Well, all of these feelings are familiar to everybody in this room. Except if you're not a religious person, you don't even have words to describe these great things. You know, you have to use words such as mysticism and spiritualism and transcendence. You have to use religious words to express these feelings that we all have. And so to some extent, quarantine I needed to have a religious subject to allow me, the atheist, to start to think about those things, because us atheists don't have our vocabulary, in an odd way, to think about these things without religion at our shoulder.
I think it's probably well past time when I should give other people the chance. I'm sorry, I got sucked in, carried away. Would anybody here like to ask Jim a question, or indeed tell him anything they think about?
I don't believe what you said about how you evolve and produce a novel.
I can't remember what it was now.
Well, it sounded to me as if the thing evolved. You didn't mean to write about Christ or something, but something happened and then it went on further and further. A natural sort of process. And you said also that you don't research because it's not a fact book, so you don't have to research and so on. Now, I've written the equivalent of about 40 books, I guess, and they're all technical books, so I have to research like mad. But I write a book in about 15 to 20 days. I write about 30 pages a day. 10 days, 15 days, I have 300 pages. It's a technical book that goes to the Cabinet Office. I rewrote the higher education system for South Africa for Mandela. It took me 4 weeks. But I'd researched it for 2 years. But I never thought about what I was writing. I sit down and I write, and the words are just there. Now, this is about me. Now, I want to come back to you. This is why I don't believe you. I mean, you know, nicely. By the way, I'm a Brummie, so thanks for living in Birmingham. I suspect that you've got a whole structure. I'm being devil's advocate here a little bit. That is subconsciously there. You've hinted at it with the natural history stuff, that you know about that. And I suspect, my doctor's in psychology, but I have degrees in physics and cybernetics and chemistry, so I come from both angles, and the psychologist in me suspects that in fact there's a lot of structure in your mind and it's screaming to come out. But you don't let yourself know that. And that is a secret that makes your writing so magical. Because you're not in contact, in one sense, consciously with the subconscious. So it creeps out. And that's lovely. Now, any comments on that?
Well, of course that's right. But as far as I'm concerned, being a rationalist, it's the conscious part that matters. I mean, the subconscious is there. And the subconscious exists in all the chambers of our world, particularly narrative. Of course there's a kind of a subconscious about narrative, because, and now I'm going to get preacherly again, but because narrative is ancient. Human beings have been telling stories for thousands and thousands of years, and we've become good at it. And what that means is that when I, somebody that just has 70 years, and whose imprint on the world of narrative is going to be tiny in the grand schemes of things, when I sit down and start writing a story, there are thousands and thousands of years of narrative that have gone before, and thousands of narratives that have proven themselves before me. And narrative, of course, in that case, I'm sounding New Agey now, I don't want to, but narrative becomes wise. It learns a few things. It establishes protocols. It understands shape. It knows what works. And so when you, and we all know this, you know, we all know it instinctively when we're in a pub and we're telling an anecdote, and some nights it goes really well, and some nights that same anecdote doesn't go so well. Sometimes we're in the zone and sometimes we're not in the zone. And what do we mean by the zone? It means that we're just tapping in really well into all of those traditions of narrative. And that's what you hope is going to happen. But if you think about it too much when you're writing, which is why the subconscious is important, if you think about it too much, it doesn't deliver itself. But when it does deliver itself, it's generous. Narrative is wise, and narrative is generous. And it comes in on your behalf. And I think that's all that was happening when I was on that chapter that I was writing about Jesus. I'd made, as a conscious person, a bad decision not to have Jesus as a character. But narrative made a good decision and abandoned my bad decision and brought Jesus in. And it wasn't as a vicar said to me on a radio show that God was standing at my shoulder while I was writing it. It was the imp of narrative. Narrative is playful. And so that's what happens.
I've forgotten what I was going to say, actually, because I was so enthralled in what you were saying, so I can imagine how a priest would want that angle on the... And it's a romantic angle anyway, which is all good. I suppose it's about... I think you did write Arcadia, didn't you?
I did,
yeah. As well, yeah, because I read Quarantine about 10 years ago as well, and then Being Dead and then Arcadia, and I thought the style in Arcadia was quite different in terms of the words, and to me, in my memory, there was a big leap between Arcadia and Quarantine and then Being Dead, and your style seemed to change. I mean, I'm not a literary sort of student or anything, I just read, and I was wondering if that was the case, and when you sort of, when you found your voice, and whether your voice comes through the editing or in that sort of initial inspiration, the narrative that you were just describing then.
Well, I think that if you read Arcadia, that sentence by sentence, you could have no doubt, if you were sad enough to involve yourself at this level, you could have no doubt that it's one of my books because of the rhythmic qualities and because of the way that each sentence, the demeanour of each sentence. I think that every one of my books is unmistakably by the same person. However, I change subject matters from one book to the next radically. And the reason I do that is that I'm not an autobiographical writer. If you're an autobiographical writer, your books have one thing in common, and that is they're all about you. So, you know, so when you read, for example, Hemingway, it feels like a mirror has been held up to a writer and you're seeing an image of Hemingway in the books and you're seeing and in the Hemingway yourself, you're seeing the books mirrored by Hemingway himself. But I'm not an autobiographical writer for a simple reason, that if I went along to my publisher and said, I'm going to write an autobiographical novel, and they said, what's it about? I'd say, well, it's about a happy childhood. I was never beaten. I never heard my mum swear. I've been married for 33 years. I've never cheated. I mean, they don't want that kind of books. Fiction does not like happy stories. Fiction prefers divorce to long marriages. Fiction prefers illness to good health. Fiction prefers death to longevity. Fiction prefers war to peace. And it does so for good reason. It does so because one of the functions of fiction, one of the functions that has been brewed after all, over all those thousands of years I was talking about, was to prepare you for the dark things that life can can throw up. So, in that respect, I'm a very traditional writer. I write about dark things in order to prepare myself and my readers for the bad things that can happen in life. But because I'm not writing about myself, I need to find a different subject every time. And when you find a different subject, you have to find a different voice to match it. And Arcadia was a book set in the current... It was a book about architecture and town planning. You imagine how pleased my publisher was. I remember actually telling my publisher, they said, what's your next book about? And I said, it's about architecture and town planning. And they put their hands over their faces. They said, never say that in public.
You know what Frank Kermode said about... You must know what Frank Kermode said about Arcadia.
What did he say?
He said, because it's a bit about markets. And he said, Arcadia, you would think the author had spent his life studying fruit and vegetables.
Right. Yes. Well, I have. And it's not a bad thing to know stuff about. So with Arcadia, I had to, in a way, I had to abandon my folktale tone. Because folktales seem to, and I'm going to generalise horribly here, that folktales are more comfortable in a non-European setting. They're more comfortable if set in the past. The modern world, the tone of the modern world narrative doesn't lend itself entirely to folktales. So there was a different quality and a different tone in Arcadia. And what happened when Arcadia came out, when Quarantine came out after Arcadia, somebody wrote that I was a very dangerous writer because I abandoned my newfound readers with every new book that I wrote. And that has been one of my dangers. I get a readership of people who are interested in town planning and vegetables. And then I get the Christians and the atheists. And then I get people who are obsessed with death. And then I get people who are food obsessives. But I never keep anyone for more than one book.
I don't think that's true. Well, just to say thanks very much to Jim for coming and talking to us.
Thanks to you, John.
No.
Because John will be here in because he's very fickle. He's making a fuss of me now, but in a fortnight's time, it'll be somebody else.
I'll be sucking up to Edna O'Brien, which will be a rather different sort of experience, methinks.
But it's a great... it's one of those great rendezvous spots. Now I'm going to buff you up here. Yeah. It's one of those great rendezvous spots for me in The Guardian on a Saturday to turn to the book club and to see a book discussed in a way which isn't judgmental, but is smart. So we're grateful for
that.
Well,
you've got to write to that Rusbridger man and tell him instantly. But anyway, I think it's you we're thanking, really. So thanks very much.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.